So what I was saying is that spirituality overall, that you say design is about bringing spirituality, etc., and centering yourself, I tend to disagree there, because what's happening very recently is that you look at apps like WhatsApp, Instagram, etc., which are considered the epitome of good design. They actually hook you on to something and get you to consume more rather than be centered by yourself. So it's actually taking you away from yourself and telling you that good design is actually what makes you consume more, spend more time outside of yourself. So what do you have to say about that?
Wow. Yeah, I think...
it's a matter of a lot of speculation.
I think the point is this. Experience design inherently aims to create more pleasantness. But often, I think that turns, that outcome gets twisted and turned into the opposite of pleasantness. What seems as a pleasant activity in the beginning, oh, I'm just looking through WhatsApp, oh, this is so nice, I'm so connected, ultimately serves to disconnect you from people around you. And that is a very, very interesting phenomenon that, Marshall McLuhan, who was one of the foremost kind of culture and technology philosophers of the 1970s, said that after technology becomes so powerful, it becomes ubiquitous, its good impact actually completely reverses itself. So if mobile technology was supposed to keep us more connected and make us more happy, now it's actually having the reverse effect. So I actually agree with you. I won't let you draw me into a conflict here, because for once I do agree with you.
For me, on the other hand, what ends up happening is it often is sort of at crossroads, right? That is the idealized notion of what experience design is and how interaction should be crafted for ideal or sort of optimum enjoyment and optimum delight in experiences. Unfortunately, what also tends to happen is oftentimes there are numbers that need to be met. And like I said earlier, one of the things that we are always doing, especially when we're crafting experiences for clients, is there are key metrics that need to be met, and there are numbers associated with each of them. And it's usually a toss-up between trying to optimize for delight and optimize for results. And that leads to a lot of these dark patterns, as you called them earlier. Dark patterns are a matter of pretty intense debate in the design community itself. Any true-blooded designer hates the idea of them. Unfortunately, more often than not, we also end up engaging in them. And this is just one of those intrinsic conflicts that we are always trying to resolve. Do you make the buy button a more prominent color than the cancel button, right? It's things like that. Do I force you to follow another user before I can see updates, or can I start seeing updates regardless? Things like that, which sort of have deep systemic implications and repercussions of those actions, often happen because you're trying to work with daily engagement metrics or daily active users, or you're trying to optimize a sales funnel. You're trying to optimize the time to completion for a purchase.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll just, jump in there, Premarkan, because experience design is a tool. You can use it to create a good thing or a bad thing, right? Just like a pen can be used to write a good thing or a bad thing. I think experience design is a powerful medium. You can use it to create pleasantness. You can use it to create harmony, or you can use it to create loneliness and disharmony and other social ills. In fact, if you look at Facebook and the likes, invented infinite scroll. Infinite scroll was this endless dopamine impact, right? Which just gets people to just keep scrolling endlessly through that feed. Now, suddenly, over the last 2-3 years, since all of these psychology reports start coming out about its impact, people there were like, oh, we were too successful actually in trying to keep people hooked. Now, iPhone comes in with a built-in report that gets sent to you every time where you can check how much time you spent on your phone.
Digital well-being is a thing now.
Why are they even doing that now? It's because they realize they need to backtrack from what the Frankenstein they created, because they really ultimately lost track of the fact that experience is, the end goal is to create more pleasantness, not the other way around.
Yeah, it's horses for courses. Sometimes it's about trying to optimize for making sure that your user is in the clearest headspace, a la an app like Headspace, for instance, or Calm, or any of these products. On the other hand, there are products, entire business models and revenue models dependent entirely on a drip feed of dopamine. And as a designer working on any of these platforms, you're trying to always optimize for both of those things. And more often than not, commercial and sort of revenue angles tend to win out because yay, capitalism. But yeah, it's something that we're very conscious of, cognizant of, and something that we're always trying to the best of our ability, try and combat so that, because at the end of the day, we're all trying to give the users the best experience. Sometimes in trying to do that best experience, you end up creating harmful effects, and you're also trying to counteract and sort of counterbalance those.
Let's talk about that a little bit in detail, Premankan. So most of the generation that's sort of getting access to the internet right now, you're talking about kids who are, you know, getting their first smartphone. Even people in rural India who are getting access to a smartphone for the first time, dirt cheap internet for the first time, their experience of design, their experiences of tech are basically TikTok, WhatsApp, Facebook, you know, versus us who were introduced to, say, an Internet Explorer, Microsoft Word, Excel, as our formative, you know, tech experiences. So how do you design for the next billion who is sort of used to that infinite scroll, who's used to, you know, your that dopamine spike every time you use an app or they lose interest? You'll see, especially on Zoom as well right now, a lot of people that I will sort of join a call, hang out there for 10, 15 minutes and leave and do something else. So how do you design for engagement and getting people to learn and design a good experience for them, but at the same time, keep them hooked, because that's important as well?
So I would definitely make a sort of differentiation here between designing for the next billion users, as that phrase has commonly been known in the design community, versus some of the points that you just raised, because they're two different things. Designing for the next billion also affects things like accessibility, connectivity, and I'm talking about the lack of all of these things. Whereas when you're talking about a generation that has sort of come to terms with the internet always being at their fingertips, a scroll or a touch away, there are different considerations that go into play, right? When you're designing a product that is meant for a generation who have fast internet and are always used to being able to get to what they want as quickly as possible, your design considerations are far more about being impulse driven and being as quick as possible. And a lot of the sort of methodical methodologies tend to go out of the window. But that does not necessarily mean it's designing for the next billion users, because there is also the consideration of, sure, proliferation of pretty powerful smartphones with easy access to 4G data has, for instance, brought an entire generation of Indians who skipped the 3G movement, suddenly have fast internet. And right, you likely said, they came on with the TikTok generation. TikTok has sort of become the poster child for this generation, for good or for worse. But there is a lot more to it. What's interesting is, if you look at things like, sure, the Facebooks and the WhatsApps are the de facto currency of this new sort of economy and this new world. But what's also very interesting is how your mediums have changed. How you engage and interact with products has changed. What's interesting is, a lot of people who are coming online for the first time with the advent of WhatsApp are not actually typing. They're actually sending out voice notes, which is now very easy to do just because it doesn't take a million years for your note to upload because fast 4G. If you look at like Google Zeitgeist reports and stuff, you'll notice that year on year over the last 5 years, voice searches in India have gotten exponentially faster and have gotten exponentially bigger. There's like a multiple 100%. I don't have the exact stat top of my head right now, but it's in the multiples of hundreds percent per year, year on year growth of things like voice interfaces. I'm not saying chatbots, because I'm not talking about Alexa and Google Assistant and stuff. I'm talking about straight away going into Google and just tapping the microphone icon and just talking into it. And that has increased. That brings in sort of new complexities for us designers who have primarily operated more in visual media. How do you sort of stay up to date with that, and how do you adapt to it? What happens? There are certain paradigms and existing traditions in design about how do you design an optimal search experience? And every designer is familiar with those things. What happens in a world where you're not typing at all to get to your search? How do you filter results when you don't have sliders available? That changes the conversation significantly.
So how do you do that, Saurabh? How do you sort of look at the world changing in the world of Alexa, TikTok, etc.? how do you see design evolving? How do you see designers evolving? All that you've studied is people have a different take on what you were taught growing up.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the big things for me that's, and I'm really happy that some of that change is happening now, is the so-called vernacularization of the internet in India. Yeah. I think, you know, Premankan talked about voice. I think it's awesome. But I think, you know, apart from those who use voice, which is basically because they're not able to really read through what is on the interface, so they're kind of using the voice as an alternative. I think what we have to really do, if we really care about the next billion, is first of we speak in their language. Second is, you know, beyond the TikToks and the entertainment apps yeah. of the world, what do we really want to first address as needs of the people now that we will empower with technology? Because I think there's a Maslow's hierarchy of digital needs also, right? So now, can digital be used to give them you know, healthcare? Can it be used to actually give them an English education that they really crave for? You know, one of the things I read about why migrants actually came to the big cities in the first place, you know, in all the pandemic news that was going on. It was not because they were starving in their villages necessarily, it's because most of them want their children to have an English education. I'm saying those are the things that really, you know, keep me thinking about how, you know, I can use technology to get farmers the pricing information they need, about the weather information they need, about the education they need. How many people can actually use their quite powerful phones now beyond TikTok and actually do some banking? I would love to have them send money to each other without going to the branch and do that, because that's our experience of technology now, right? And that is not their experience yet. So yes, we all use TikTok, but I think that's a very surface level use of technology still.
And sort of tying into that Maslow's hierarchy of needs, I mean, self-actualization later, you have need to be met. What interesting is when you're speaking the language that your user understands and the language that your user speaks, that has massive implications from a design perspective, both visual, auditory, any other sensory means that you can think of for designers as a challenge to take up. Recently, I worked on a project with one of the largest banks in the country where they were offering a sort of a man-in-the-middle solution for in the logistics space for farmers in, obviously, in rural India. And we had to design an app which was obviously localized, and it was regionalized into different languages depending on which part of India the app was being deployed and the product was being deployed. Essentially, the idea being that there's a subsidiary that buys stock from the farmers and then basically sells it directly to the government, so the farmers don't have to deal with that. And all the interim logistical steps like cold storage and things like that, the bank and their subsidiary handles a lot of that and it promises to give a better rate without any of the ongoing expenses associated with it. What's interesting is when you realize that your farmer who cannot piece together an entire sentence of English, and why would they, are perfectly familiar with words like cold storage. So how do you accommodate for that? What's a common visualization of cold storage in a product meant for lower literacy rates or quicker, easier access on an interface? That's a challenge. And that's a very interesting challenge to take on.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, one of the practical kind of case studies that I had to deal with many times is, you know, if you work with a lot of the NBFCs who provide small loans to people at the bottom of the pyramid, you know, they create these very elaborate digital platforms to process those loans, right? And so you can theoretically go to any one of these apps and then, you know, just give all your documents, fill in all your information and get a loan approved, completely digital. But the reality is most people, most of their target segments actually just pick up the phone and get an agent to come meet them to do all of that.
Yeah.
So for me, the real test of whether we have been able to do a good job of getting digital to the next billion is when somebody, one of these NBFCs can actually give off loans digitally.
Yeah.
Right now, that's not the case. The app is there, but it's not getting used. That's just to show that, yeah, we are digital.
I said, is that poor design then? Because if these people in rural India can use WhatsApp, Facebook with as much finesse as someone like me or someone like you, Premankan, who's a designer, can, then what is it? Is it poor design that's stopping them from being able to use a banking app? Or is it just a mental block? Is it lack of education on their end? What is the actual problem you're solving
for? You know, the first thing I learned about user experience design, it's never the user's fault.
It's never the user's fault.
100% the designer's fault. So I take the blame. I think Premyank and you have to take the blame too.
Always, always. 100%. Anytime my user did not understand my interface, that is not the user's fault. It means I failed to communicate on my interface.
Yeah, and I failed to understand the user. That's why they haven't understood me. I think, you know, if we approach a design problem by assuming, oh, it's the user's fault, then I think we've lost the battle in the beginning itself. And that's why I was saying that the first step is to really experience the user. How many of us have actually gone down to understand what's a day in the life of somebody who applies for a small loan, who runs a little small scooter, you know, workshop, you know, that he set up with his own money and now needs a loan to continue growing that. You know, if we can get down to his day in the life and really internalize that, then I think we have, you know, a much better chance of actually delivering a solution that works.
Yeah, I completely agree.
If you see people like, why has WhatsApp been so successful? Why has Facebook been so successful? These are foreign companies with a completely different Western design mindset coming into India and deploying a solution for India has been very successful. I'll be hard-pressed to think of a single digital Indian company that has been as successful as them in terms of being able to reach the masses. Why is there a huge disconnect there? Do they just have better designers than us? Do they understand India better than us Indians understand India? What is the problem?
So I'm going to take a stab at this before Saurabh jumps into this. And I'm going to speak just purely, this is purely anecdotal and this is based entirely on my experiences so far. One of the things that tends to happen is this ties in back to an extent, the design maturity of an organization. What tends to also end up happening is sometimes, yes, is it the designer's fault? Always. But what also tends to happen is you're like any other industry, like any other field, when you're getting a job done, you're balancing a whole bunch of different things. You're balancing resources, you're balancing timelines, you're balancing budgets. You're trying to work a bunch of different things into actually getting the job done. What tends to happen is when a Facebook or a Google decides to invest in a new market space, oftentimes, just as a function of economics, owing to their sheer size and whatever, it's a lot easier, for instance, to get into a three-month engaged immersion phase. Uber decides to launch a new app. And these are, by the way, common case studies that all designers look up to, and we all study them, look at them, sometimes with a healthy amount of jealousy. Is you look at these immersion trips, right? Where you want to understand how your user works. That's not always necessarily a luxury that you're granted when you're working on projects that don't usually involve one of the giants of the tech world. Oftentimes what tends to happen is you're working within the paradigm of the budget constraints. You're working within a constraint of your timelines, and the necessary infrastructure around it often has to be built up from scratch,
I said, these are our people. If we don't know our country and our people, and we can't design for them, that's a problem. We don't need, you know, we've been brought up in Indian culture. We have.
No, but we haven't though. That's the big thing we tend to offer. India is not even remotely homogenous. The India that you've been brought up in is very different from the India that I've been brought up in, and is very different from the India that most of the participants on the Zoom call right now have been brought up in. And the fact that we are all sitting here at 5 o'clock on a weekday on Zoom on a, you know, podcast means none of the people on this call right now, any of us, have deep insights. I'm just sort of gesturing here, but probably have the insights into what a rice farmer in West Bengal lives in, right? So what immersion is one of the best ways to understand that. As an urban millennial, my experiences are very different. And I'm working with my preconceived biases. And no matter how much you try, there are certain preconceived biases and notions that everybody works with. The challenge is, how do you let go of your preconceived ideas and your notions, immerse yourself into the day in the life of your user, and take away what you need to be able to build an effective solution. And that is like sort of the holy grail of being able to do effective design. So while it is absolutely on us to try and do that, there are a lot of logistical factors that go into why that's not always possible. And that's just something I want to highlight.
So the only thing I would say to add to that, Umang and Premankan, is that, you know, in trying to design for the next billion, and when you say the next billion, I'm assuming you mean Indians, you don't necessarily, you know, assume that designing for the next billion means designing in some Indian way or using a completely Indianized solution. That's not necessarily true. Designing for the next billion means going out into the world of design, choosing whatever approach, whatever platform, doesn't matter where it comes from the world, but finding that and knowing that, oh, this actually might serve to be an optimal solution. And I'll tell you why something like WhatsApp sometimes works universally. A CEO is using it, and a maid is using it, and a rice farmer is using it. Because one of the things that you learn as a user experience designer, once you start understanding the science behind it, is that there are two aspects to understanding people. One is that people across the globe, all human beings, are similar in many ways, right? Our hardwiring in our brains, our default nuances around our limits to short-term memory, the fact that all human beings are social animals and we have a strong need to connect, they're all the same. If you're a human being, you'll have a lot of things that are similar. But what makes you different is your context, your culture, and your climate. So there possibly would be things like WhatsApp, which somehow tap into a universal need to connect and have a generic enough design language that spans across cultures.
I don't think that local context.
I don't think that the success of WhatsApp means we don't need a, you know, Indianized approach, because in some cases, depending on the problem you're solving, you might need a more localized solution. In other cases, a universal solution works. So I think we have to be open-minded about being universal, global, and local as required, not just default to just one or the other as a mutually exclusive approach.
And where this context really comes into play is a WhatsApp, which might transcend your local cultural context, does not translate directly to something like taking a loan or finance. It's the cultural context there that defines. It's no harder getting a credit card in India than a lot of other places in the world. Culturally, we're taught credit is bad, which has a deep implication on the popularity of credit cards in India, where people who are perfectly comfortable and able to afford credit cards don't take credit cards because the concept of credit is socioculturally frowned upon in India. So those cultural contexts don't always have a apples to apples comparison.
So why don't we then have, say, you know, people with enough money, someone like Cred coming in now, we have companies who are trying to, you know, shift the Indian mindset, introduce new habits and practices to them. But then again, you see someone like WhatsApp or Google come in and take over a Paytm's market share in overnight, basically, as you said. And because they're able to, you know, adapt and think faster than an Indian homegrown startup, which has just as many funds, if you know, and just as many people working on the same solution. What is it about our designers and our design practices that you say will need to shift or evolve in order to be able to compete or get a good design-led homegrown startup that to do actually well in these markets?
So I'll just take a stab at that, Umang. So, you know, I think the answer lies in being somewhere in the middle, right? I think you need to leverage global best practices and apply local realities on top of it. And I'll give you a great example of that. Something that I think doesn't get talked enough about in the design world as a success case study, Domino's. 30 minutes night of free, for me, really told me that in a culture of so much uncertainty, where you can't really expect anything to happen on time, the one thing that happens on time is your pizza delivery. And that for me is a great mashup of global best practice, the speed, system, and scalability of creating pizzas quickly, and then the localized aspiration of people wanting certainty. And that just created this massive success. And I think that's a good template for what we need to do to create world-class solutions that actually solve real problems.
And I will come back to the importance of the necessary infrastructure and logistics involved in pulling off design at a massive scale. something that you don't always have access to. And like you said, yes, more and more companies today have the funds to be able to pull it off. And some of them are actually doing a good job and they are actually managing to sort of permeate into the underserved areas of, let's say, the economy. That said, when a Paytm manages to make a successful foray post demonetization and suddenly seemingly overnight, Paytm is a success story and everybody has Paytm installed in their phone. But then when Google comes out with Google Pay, suddenly Google Pay is on everybody's phone as well. A lot of that is just a function of reach and distribution and being able to have that kind of widespread impact, which not a lot of startups and companies especially tend to have. Even a large bank in India does not, for instance, often always have the same reach as, let's say, a Facebook or a Google does. So these companies tend to sort of also operate as platform operators. They operate at a scale that is sort of unimaginable for a lot of organizations. And while it's not the most politically correct thing to say, unfortunately, what tends to happen is it is a very real thing that does have massive implications. And I'm sure Saurav will agree to this as well. Being able to suggest to a client that I'm going to take a 3-month immersion trip when a product is due in 6 months, it's not always going to be looked upon kindly.